For Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's episode, the creative team behind the new film, Chappaquiddick, which tells the true story of Ted Kennedy's 1969 car accident, resulting in the death of campaign staff member Mary Jo Kopechne.
Our hope was that this movie would really honor the legacy of Mary Jo Kopechne.
We'll also hear from New Girl creator Elizabeth Merriweather.
I think it's so important to, like, just try to get your work produced in any way possible.
We'll also hear from playwright and Academy Award-winning filmmaker Kenneth Lonergan.
I found in each film that I've done that every single accident that happened on camera was something I always really wanted to put in the movie. And I think it's a lesson to me to loosen up, you know, a bit.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. Listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. The new film, Chappaquiddick, depicts the events following Ted Kennedy's 1969 late-night single-car accident that resulted in the death of one of his campaign staff members. I spoke with writers Taylor Allen and Andrew Logan and director John Curran about the research required to write a true story and the responsibility they felt depicting the victim, Mary Jo Kopechne. The following discussion was recorded at the Austin Film Festival after a screening of Chappaquiddick at the Paramount Theater. Clips of Chappaquiddick, courtesy of Apex Entertainment and Entertainment Studios Motion Pictures.
My dad once said to me, tragedy has a way of defining people. Cripples some people till they curl up into a ball.
Oh my God, what have I done?
Hello, Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Kennedy.
Dad? See, you're still the man with all the influence.
What the hell happened, Teddy?
It was an accident. I was driving.
A story like this could dominate the headlines for weeks.
Tell us how you all connected with this project. I mean, this is sort of that great story that didn't get told forever. So what made you all think that this was the time to be telling it?
Me and Andrew wrote this movie together. We actually both grew up in Dallas. So, like, the Kennedy legacy loomed very large for us in our childhood. I was joking to Andrew backstage just a moment ago that last year, like, Jackie was our Star Wars. Like, that was, like, how invested in the Kennedy family we were. But we had never seen an actor play Ted Kennedy. And I personally found him to be, like, the most relatable and, like, the most interesting Kennedy family member, being the youngest and having this legacy thrust upon him through tragedy. And so really, you know, the impetus for wanting to write this was really just to explore Ted Kennedy as a man. We were very lucky to have John Curran come on board as director.
Yeah, I mean, I just read a very great script. I mean, by the time it got to me, it was very developed, and Jason was attached, and I've known Jason for a long time. I used to live in Australia. He was actually in my very first film. So the combination of Jason and a great script, for me, that was kind of a no-brainer. But it was very curious to me that Ted was a very revered and also much maligned character. And I think while he was alive, it would have been difficult to make this film objectively. But I think, you know, he's been dead for almost 10 years now. But it was curious that no one had really approached his story before.
So where did you do your research for this? Some of it clearly is made up.
Less so than you think. Andrew's dad is a lawyer. And that was a very guiding force for us both. Father figures in the movie loom large, and in both of our lives, Andrew's lawyer father was telling us, if you're going to write about the Kennedys, you got to be buttoned up, as they say.
It was always a matter of cutting out things and being focused on the story and making sure that we were telling the best possible version of it. Because we did really, you know, get really in the weeds on the research, and that's why you end up with an almost 200-page script.
So actually, our first source of information was 6 months after the accident took place. They held an inquest into whether or not a crime had been committed in the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. And the inquest, they called everyone back to Martha's Vineyard. The Boiler Room Girls, the U.S. attorney played by Jim Gaffigan, and, you know, Joe Gargan, and even Ted Kennedy himself, they all went on the stand and went under oath. And it adds up to about 1,000 pages of court testimony transcript. And we read that transcript like 3 times and like, reading it the third time, you're like, why did I highlight that the first time? And you find out that, like, there's little details and nuances of behavior and thought that influence the writing. On the one hand, nobody's privy to the conversation between the Boiler Room Girl, Rachel, and Ted at the funeral. But when she took the stand, she said, I was the only one who talked to him at the funeral. And the only thing I wanted to ask him was, how's your wife, Senator? And that was like this opportunity as writers to ask, like, what was that conversation? Like, that's such an interesting question to ask. You know, even though we don't always have the answers, we have a lot of different perspectives that we're drawing from.
Yeah, when I read the script, there was about 12 notes that I made of things that I just thought were writer inventions. And when I first met with Andrew and Taylor, I kind of walked them through, okay, what about this? What about that? And every single one of them, they were authentic plot points. Was there a deputy that actually happened to be the only witness to the two of them in the car? Yes. I mean, there's a lot of things like that are very basic to the story that are kind of make it really outrageous.
Well, one of the things that's so really haunting in it is that you don't really get a great sense of Mary Jo Kopechne, and I don't think you did back then either. And so in your process of that research, how did you find out much about her? I mean, did her parents ever do interviews?
No, the Kopechne parents in particular were very quiet after the accident. We did as much research as we could because ultimately our hope was that this movie would really honor the legacy of Mary Jo Kopechne. And you see that newspaper that Joe Gargan sets down and says, blonde drowns. And that was really the attitude that was pervasive at the time, was she was a floozy, she was a secretary. And hopefully after seeing this movie, you see she was a talented campaign worker, an intelligent woman, and, you know, somebody that was mourning the loss of Bobby Kennedy along with Ted, and that ultimately this was a life cut tragically short. And so we hope when you see that bridge at the end, that that's the legacy of her and that's the echo of her.
What were we going to say before I interrupted about Bobby?
No, never mind.
No? Go on, you're going to ask after Bobby was killed. Why didn't I run in his place? What would you have done? I don't know, if you were me and he was your brother, what would you have done?
I'd quit, leave Washington, never look back. Which is exactly what I did. But I'm not you. He wasn't my brother.
Yeah, well, I had 3 generations of advisors up my trying to convince me to run. None of them listened to me. I mean, everyone tried to convince me otherwise. Everyone except Joey said the country needed me. I just needed my name.
Well, so Bruce Dern was a really brilliant move there. Whose idea was that? Had you worked with him before?
No, I work with Laura Dern, his daughter, and had a great experience with her. And, you know, it's very difficult when you're trying to cast an older man that's playing a stroke victim in a wheelchair. It's just way too close to the bone. Most agents would say, don't even send that script to my client. He doesn't want to do that. But Bruce was all over it. From the minute we sent it to him, he was like, I'm in. He hated Joe Kennedy. He had tons of conspiracy stories about Joe. And his only complaint was that we had too much dialogue in the film for him, because there's like 5 words. Like, that's 5 words too many. I'm going to play with my eyes, is what he told me. He totally got what Joe had to be, like what in terms of the character in the film. You know, you want to cast a guy that has the baggage of being intimidating, and Bruce Dern certainly has that in spades. And he was incredible to work with. Him and Jason, really, really, really fun to work with together.
Well, the comedy was really subtle and really greatly timed.
We need to remind the American people what this family has been through and how much more we have left to achieve.
And how are you planning on doing that, Ted?
A nationally televised statement. All 3 networks, prime time.
Is that all? Why not have Ted fill in for Carson on The Tonight Show?
It's actually not a bad idea. the networks will donate the time if it's part of their news coverage.
We could frame the national conversation the way we want it framed.
Then how do we do that?
He's got to look sympathetic.
It'd be easier to get him to fill in for Carson.
You know, when I read this script, it was what struck me was my response to it. It was a very visceral reaction of getting sucked into the tragedy and the pathos of it, and then finding myself laughing, and then laughing at what felt like very inappropriate things to be laughing at. And I just thought that was a really amazing high wire act these guys had managed with the script, and I wanted the film to do the same thing. And, you know, so I needed actors in a couple of key roles that I felt had the range to do not only the more serious, heavier drama side of their character, but also bring to it the levity. I've said this before, that there's a lot of great dramatic actors that are absolutely the most unfunny people you've ever met in your life. And they just don't get comic timing. And I've met a lot of comedic actors or comedians who actually have a really incredible range. You know, they've got obviously the comic timing and deadpan humor, but they also have this huge well of tragedy and depression that they can draw on. So guys like Jim and Ed are like these really complex, tricky guys that I felt could deliver the whole range. So yeah, when I took it on and how I responded to the script and what these guys had written, you know, they had written him as a fully fledged paradox, meaning that he was very human to me. What I liked was that he was a fully formed paradox, but I did feel for him. And I think it is important. I mean, I came from a very big family, 8 kids and a lot of boys. And the idea of being the youngest boy in a family like his, the last one alive, and all your brothers have been killed in the line of duty, and all that expectation that was thrust upon them is now on you. I mean, that must have been overwhelming. And not only that, but it's to be the president of the United States. I mean, you can't even really, when you try to imagine it, it makes for fantastic fiction, much less nonfiction. And so, you know, there's an amazing character there that, like, you're really doing a disservice to your own film if you don't come into this film and understand the weight that was on him after Bobby was shot in 68, going into 69. I think that it was literally impossible for him after that. Anytime it came up, not only for Teddy Kennedy, but guys like Ted Sorensen, all of them got burned by Chappaquiddick for the rest of their careers.
It's a writer's festival, so I'll just say this, like, when you're trying to come up with an idea for a movie, a lot of times you're like looking for a rock on the beach and you're looking through those grains of sand. But in reality, there's always this giant boulder right in front of you. And I think that Chappaquiddick was a story that people who knew about it were afraid to tell for a long time. And I think that for me and Andrew, we came at it from a much, you know, different perspective, having never heard the story growing up. The first time we heard the story was actually in 2008. And the only reason that I know what Chappaquiddick is because Ted Kennedy endorsed Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton. And then Bill Maher on Real Time with Bill Maher was like, Ted Kennedy has changed presidential history again and endorsing Barack Obama. He would have been president in 1972 had it not been for Chappaquiddick. And like, Chappaquiddick is a weird word. And so when Bill Maher just moved on and he was like, new rule, I was like, whoa, you have to explain what Chappaquiddick is. And like, that was the moment where it was like, oh, I've already been obsessed with the Kennedys and how did I not know this? And so that was like the opportunity, honestly.
Our On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Next up, we'll hear from New Girl creator Elizabeth Merriweather. The Fox comedy series starring Zooey Deschanel is currently in its 7th and final season. The show has been nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards and 5 Emmy Awards. Before working in television, Merriweather started her career as a New York playwright. She spoke with House of Cards creator Bo Willimon at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of New Girl, courtesy 20th Century Fox Television, Elizabeth Merriweather Pictures, and Chernin Entertainment. Yeah.
you began in the theater as an actor and also a writer. Can you talk about some of your earliest memories, experiences in the theater?
I just started writing a lot my sophomore year of college. The first thing I wrote, it was called The Touch, The Feel. And it was a girl talking to the personification of cotton. I think it was amazing. I really think it was like a beautiful play. Actually, it was starring Zoe Kazan, who is now like a, you know, she's an amazing actress and she's a writer herself. And she occasionally texts me and she's like, remember when I was in that play where I had to talk to cotton for a really long time?
Those early plays and stuff that you were writing at Yale, were those being done by you and your friends? I mean, were you putting them up?
Yeah, I mean, one of the good things about Yale is that they are very encouraging of students to kind of work together and put on productions. That was really important for me. And what was amazing for me was the friends that I met there. And I kind of kept working with them in New York after college. And I just think that's so important, getting a community of people and making stuff, because that's how you learn about your writing and that's how you learn what works and what doesn't. For example, don't make a guy be cotton.
Around that time, you wrote a play, one of my favorite plays, yours, Mistakes Madeline Made, a young woman who's a receptionist, and I'll let you describe the play, but it really tackled that time of uncertainty in a young person's life. I know that you were actually an assistant to a family and, you know, drew from that in order to write the play, but that time in your life and juggling, like, I'm an assistant doing these odd, bizarre things and also trying to write plays. Can you talk a little bit about that part of your journey?
I think it was about 20.
Holy.
I was the second assistant to the wife, if that makes sense. You know? It was truly bizarre. It was my first job out of college, and I had to sign like a ton of non-disclosure agreements, which then I broke all of them. I have so many stories about that. But and I was fired after 6 weeks because I forgot the driver would pick the kids up from school in like a town car. And I was supposed to put the kids' snacks in the town car with the driver. And I forgot to put the kids' snacks in and I got fired. But it's like, again, I think sometimes it's like you need those like kick in the pants to kind of get going. You know, and it really shook me. It was my first job out of college. I got fired. Some really good stuff has come from that anger. Like things in your life that like really deeply piss you off, I think can sometimes kickstart your system a little bit and like get you writing. And that play just kind of poured out of me because I was like so upset that I'd, you know, been fired and kind of also mad at myself. But it was sort of a thing where my friend was working in a theater in New York and she was working underneath the main literary manager. She was like the assistant literary manager and her boss was on maternity leave and she called me and she was like, I think I can get you a reading. And she's like, do you have a play? And I did not have the play written. And I was like, I have a play, absolutely. Like, and she gave me a date for a reading. That's when I wrote the play.
I was at that reading.
Yeah.
And then I think you like ran out right afterwards.
I used to hide after readings. Like literally I would find like a table and like hide under them.
Around that time you were also developing Sluts, which was your first, how you started your relationship with Fox. You were tackling a show that was about four young women, also sort of the beginning of their adult life, trying to figure things out.
If you don't live in LA, you're just on conference calls all the time, which are, they're sort of horrible. And I was always just like, I was always in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I'd be like going into a McDonald's in Times Square, like trying to pretend like I was professional, you know, on these conference calls. But I'd written this long list of ideas for shows and I'd had like long paragraphs of things. And then at the very end, as a joke, it just said Sluts. And I get on the call, the conference call, and the producer who I'd never met before was like, so we're going to go forward with Sluts. And I was like, what? I was like, no, I had like all these like brilliant, thought out, really intelligent ideas. And then I was like, okay, that was my, you know, introduction to Hollywood. So, but I mean, it had like a, you know, eye-catching title, but it was really just about, you know, it was sort of a very bad version of Girls. If Girls had been made like 5 years earlier for network, which would have been terrible. So
I saw the pilot and I thought it was great. There have been a number of shows, and still probably not enough, that are tackling the lives of young women.
It was very much like, it was sort of, you know, before Bridesmaids, before everything. And just the notes were insane. You know, it's like, I don't understand how she can like sex and be smart. I mean, really, just like those were the conversations I was having. And so it really is amazing how much has changed in the, I guess I've been doing this for like 10 years now, but in that time, like, it's amazing and it's really great. But when we were making Sluts, it was, you know, a different, it was really like people really didn't know how to do a show with only women and really were uncomfortable with the idea of a woman as a lead. And it was a different sort of time.
Well, what was incredible is we were at Juilliard at the same time that Liz was developing Sluts, and we were all sitting in this room with Marcia Norman and Chris Durang, two amazing playwrights who ran that program, and like taking our plays very seriously and all that. And Liz was doing the same, but also starting up a television show potentially. And we were all sort of in awe of this person who had somehow figured it out.
Well, you know? I also had this horrible breakup at that time, like really bad sort of like, it's on and off for 6 years, kind of college thing. And I was like actually sobbing on the streets of New York, and Bo showed up and took me to a diner and like bought me French fries, and he does an amazing like Daffy Duck impression. And actually I talked about this friendship in the pitch for New Girl, because it was a moment in my life when I was, I obviously have a ton of women who are friends, but it was a moment when, like, I know if I'd called a female friend, she would have, like, cried with me. And instead, Bo showed up and kind of told me to shut up and did, like, a Daffy Duck impression. And I was like, oh, like, male friends are different and kind of good in a way, you know? I mean,
you touch upon it a few times is really important. Picture this, because this actually happened. There's a bookshop in New York called the Drama Bookshop, and in the basement is the Arthur C. Lynn Theater, which is just a little tiny room that's like painted black. It's about a third of the size of this room. And around this time, we were, all of our friends and us were just doing like readings down there and, you know, or whatever. I mean, to amuse ourselves because no one else would do our work. And those people were like Liz and me, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Billy Eichner, Tommy Cale, you know, and no one gave a shit about like what any of us were doing except each other and the other 20 people we convinced to come to this basement at any given time. but everyone helped.
I've always been good at getting people to go to basements.
but everyone was supportive of each other and and helped each other. And I think it's good to remind ourselves, but also everyone in here, like you can't do it alone, you know. No strings attached. Let's pivoting.
I've always loved romantic comedy, and it was initially the script was called Buddies, and obviously, you know, I had a gimmick, which is that I had titles that were like, you know, couldn't actually be the real title of the thing, which was like Sluts and Buddies. But I've always loved romantic comedies, and I went to a meeting with a producer, and he pitched me the title for a joke. But I was really interested in that relationship, and you know, the relationship of two people who didn't want to connect emotionally but were sleeping together. So I kind of went away and wrote that movie, and then, you know, and then we found out there was a competing project of Friends with Benefits. But that whole process was, it actually took about 3 years to make that movie, which seems crazy if you've seen that movie, because it doesn't seem like the kind of movie that would take 3 years to make. But it was a really, it was actually rare as a screenwriter. I was with the project from the beginning all the way through. I went to set every day. And so it was definitely a crash course in, you know, everything. I'd never really been on a set before. So it was fascinating to kind of watch, obviously, Natalie Portman, Ashton Kutcher, I mean, and Ivan Reitman, you know, make a movie. It was just really interesting to watch. And you know, I learned so much, and the script changed a lot. You know, I mean, there was a lot of notes. There was a lot of like casting. You know, like at one point, like different actors were kind of going to be in it, and so I did huge rewrites for those actors. All of it was sort of like a, you know, interesting learning process on how to get a studio movie made.
So was New Girl being developed simultaneously to work on No Strings Attached?
I pitched it while we were finishing the editing. I remember I was writing promos for MTV while I was pitching New Girl. And then it came out, the movie came out, and we were going to shoot the pilot kind of at the same time that the movie came out. So Bo texted me this week and he was like, I haven't really seen a lot of your shows. So I'm going to have to, I'm giving him like a really hard time. Sorry. So I'm like, when he's using the character names, I'm going to make him really talk about who's Coacher Winston? Like, tell me how you feel about Coacher Winston. I'm sorry to like include you in this.
What I said is that I have not watched every episode and certainly not as many as most of the people that will be attending the talk. So I feel a little insecure not being like an uber expert.
I just want
New
you guys
Girl.
To like in the Q&A, like really grill him. On the characters and different scenes and different episodes. I just really want you to be here. Anyway, sorry.
I love you so much.
No, I mean, Jake Johnson, who ended up being Nick Miller, who's a character on the show. So he was in No Strings Attached, and I loved working with him so much. He was actually one of the first people I sent the script for the pilot of New Girl, you know. But yeah, I mean, it was... I don't know. I'm like rambling and not.
No, I just it seems like, you know, you were drawing aspects of both of those that found their way into New Girl. And when you first started developing it, I mean, did you have a pretty clear sense of these four initial characters from the get-go? Or, you know, was that a sort of, you know, bracketing, experimenting, trying a lot of different things out?
It started with kind of knowing that I knew the Nick character, I knew the Jess character, and at one point it was almost gonna just be kind of like a Will and Grace with Nick and Jess, almost like, but they obviously Nick's not gay, so it's like straight Will and Grace.
Hey Nick, any chance you understand how to put this together? I think it looks pretty easy, actually.
You know, I'm actually busy. I'm moving money around. I'm diversifying. I'm not your fluffer, by the way.
What's a fluffer?
In pornography, it's the person who keeps the actor motivated, aroused, you know?
Ew, that's a job?
And that's what I am. I'm your emotional fluffer. I'm there whenever you need a guy. You want a cup of tea? I'll make it. You lose your phone? I'll call.
You're my friend. That's what friends do.
I'm your boyfriend without the rewards.
that was always the... Again, I love romantic comedies. I think they get a really bad rap. I think there have been some really bad ones made, but and I've probably made a bad one. But I love them. I've always that's the love stories in movies. I've always just been so. That's what I love in a movie. I'll remember the love story. My greatest wish is that they kind of come back and they come back better and that they, you know, that people start making more of them again. I mean, they're very dead right now in Hollywood. Like, nobody wants to make one. It's almost like a dirty word. And I do think that a lot of romantic comedies have moved to television. And I'd always sort of saw New Girl as a love story between two friends that, you know, a man and a woman who are friends.
Are we?
No. I love you.
Well, I love you too.
More than I've ever loved anybody.
But what if that's the only thing we have in common?
I miss my friend.
I really miss my friend too.
So when's that mean? Are we...
Yeah.
How early in the process did Zoe become involved? Did you know that she was going to play Jess? And then did that inform, you know, I mean, she's such a particular actor with like such a sort of clear, unique voice. How much did that maybe inform the writing?
Yeah, I wrote it about me. I didn't have an actress in mind, and I heard that she might be interested, and then she came on and immediately started, I started writing for her. I mean, I talked about this yesterday, but I do think I said a lot, in television comedy, you have to, write to the actors you have instead of holding on to characters in your head and trying to kind of shoehorn the actors into those characters, because especially with network comedy, it's all about the chemistry, right? It's all about who these people are. And to do, I mean, we've now done well over 100 episodes, and to be able to do that, the actors really have to be, it's not playing themselves, but there has to be a lot of themselves in the characters. And so that was advice that Jake Kasdan gave me. Actually, he directed the pilot. He directed Freaks and Geeks. I don't know if you guys have seen that. It's such a good show. You should definitely see that. But that was one of his main pieces of advice, was it's all about the casting for comedy, and to like really take the time and make sure that the people you cast all have amazing chemistry together. And we did that. So long, so many auditions. We saw so many people, and we read everybody with everybody else. And Zoe, you know, to her credit, came in. She didn't have to, came in and read with a bunch of guys. And we sort of built the cast that way by seeing, you know, who was working together. What was great about that was the audition process became a time where we were actually able to rehearse the pilot, because I mean, coming from the theater, that I think that's one of the hardest things, is that there's no time for rehearsal with film and television a lot of the times, maybe more with film. But the pilot sort of audition process became a workshop for me, a chance to hear the pilot out loud. I wrote extra sides for all the characters so I could kind of test what the actors could do and what was working. And then I really did a rewrite of the script based on what I was seeing in the audition process. And it's amazing. I mean, it's because your pilot is picked up, they're going to shoot it, and you feel like it's perfect, right? Like, oh my God, I can't believe I got through that level of the video game. And then you put it up on its feet with actors in an audition setting, and you hear it literally 125 times, and you hate it so much. Like, you hate all the jokes, you hate everything. And I think it's important to really always keep working on it. I don't understand these people who sort of stop, you know, they think they have the script, it's perfect, and they stop. I think you have to work with actors and keep, you know, keep refining the script. That was a hugely important thing for our pilot. And then by the time we were shooting the pilot, all the actors had worked together, they had rehearsed together. It was a big help.
Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Next up, we'll hear from award-winning playwright and filmmaker Kenneth Lonergan. Lonergan's theatrical work includes This Is Our Youth, Lobby Hero, and The Starry Messenger. As a filmmaker, he wrote and directed You Can Count on Me,
Margaret, and Manchester by the Sea, for which he won an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. I spoke with Kenneth Lonergan at the Austin Film Festival, where he received the 2017 Distinguished Screenwriter Award. Clips of You Can Count on Me, courtesy of Paramount Classic. Clips of Manchester by the Sea, courtesy of K Films Manchester LLC and Roadside Attractions.
So I want to bring up Kenneth Lonergan. That feel more like theater to you than film?
No, I don't usually get this big a crowd.
I was just saying how much I love to analyze this, and Kenneth said that almost none of that dialogue was his original, I mean, the actual dialogue. I thought that was an interesting entree into your experience into the business, especially coming out of playwriting.
I made up the idea for the movie, juxtaposing the psychoanalytic jargon with mafia talk and that general tenor of the film. But I've never seen the film, so I'm not 100% sure. Well, it's not a joke. I've never seen it. But I read the script, because I had to read the script to decide how much credit I wanted to take, and I decided that I wanted shared story. I asked for shared story and screenplay credit. I was a playwright looking for a way to make a living that was better than the way I was making a living. I had been in, you know, involved in the theater for a long time. My roommate was making money as a screenwriter, and but I knew what happened to screenwriting, to screenplays that went to Hollywood. I got the idea for the script, and I decided to write it as a sacrifice fly or a sacrifice play, basically. And so it was intended to be sold. I knew that it could be taken away and rewritten a lot, and it was. But I also lived off of it for 2 years, 2 or 3 years. I had one script, so they pay you very well when they take your script away. Yeah, it was rewritten, I think, about 14 times. Then finally, there was 3 writers credited to it.
You're a person who's used to seeing his words out there in the way they were intended, and it was changed dramatically, and yet you still pursued a career in this.
I think one thing that I did that was good for me was that I separated my financial life from my creative life, and that was easy because there is no financial life as a playwright. It's a lot easier to have your script rewritten if you're prepared for it and you don't expect anything else, and you're using the money to do what you want to do. So it was sort of an exalted day job. And then eventually I got into film directing as a way to protect the script that I did want to control.
I think what probably some folks in here would like to hear is the process you follow when you're writing a play and the process you follow when you're writing a screenplay, and how you work in both mediums so well.
So it's just, the thing about screenplays is you can do anything, and with plays you're limited to the mechanics of the theater are so much more limited than the mechanics of a film. And the same is true for a screenplay and a play. A play is characters and a stage and a set and lights and possibly some sound. And as we all know, movies have, you know, zillions of elements to them, and screenplays can jump forward in time and back in time and tell the story in split seconds, and plays can't really do that. You can't turn the lights on and off that fast. I mean, there's physical limitations. You know, it's a big deal in the theater when someone walks into the room. That's like it's your big special effect is someone coming through the door. So it's a little different.
On that note, I mean, where do you make that distinction yourself? How, you know, this idea that's come to me, I'm going to put it into this format or that format. Is it a decision made immediately when the idea comes to you? Or?
I don't think I've ever had an idea for one that turned into the other. I think that most of my ideas for films have a somewhat sizable environmental element. You Can Count on Me started out as it's my first film. It started out as a 10-page play, or 12-page scene, really, if those of you who know the movie, it's essentially the scene between the brother and the sister in the lunchroom near the beginning of the film, which leads then into what became the last scene on the bench in the movie. And I really liked that scene. It was just the two characters, and there was no little boy. I thought I really liked the characters, and I thought they might be useful for something else. And I was watching a play that I wasn't enjoying very much that had a little boy in it, and my mind was wandering a little bit, and I thought, oh gee, what if the sister in that skit had a little boy and the brother became friendly with him but then kind of everything up. And I immediately thought that would be a really good story, and I could see the whole arc to it. And then, and I knew also right away that it was going to be a movie and not a play, because along with those thoughts came the thoughts about their feelings about the town and her feeling of confinement in the town, but also security and his feeling of restlessness. And I knew the environment would be really important. And that's something that's much harder for me to convey. And I think it's much harder for the theater to convey a sense of the outdoors. The environments in the theater can be really great, but they tend to be more indoorsy in my experience, unless you're Shakespeare and you can simply create a huge outdoor space with your language, but that's not one of my capabilities.
You mind if I ask you a personal question?
I don't know.
Do you like it here? I mean, in Scottsville?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. My friends are here. I like the scenery. I don't know.
I know. It's just so... There's nothing to do here.
Yes, there is.
No, there isn't, man. It's narrow. It's dull. It's a dull, narrow town full of dull, narrow people who don't know anything except what things are like right around here. They have no perspective whatsoever, no scope. They might as well be living in the 19th century because they have no idea what's going on. And if you try and tell them that, they want to f***ing kill you.
What are you talking about?
I have no idea. You're a good kid.
I'd really love to hear how the process worked going from having this career in theater, and then you make this, you have this idea, you realize it's better for film, and how you made those steps to prepare yourself for now directing.
You know, I'd had a couple of friends who'd made small films without too much difficulty, so that's what gave me the idea that I might be able to do the same. The script got financed because someone, John Hart, the producer had seen my play, This Is Our Youth, and he wanted to buy that for the movies. In the meantime, I had been writing You Can Count on Me, and it was pretty much ready by the time I closed the deal with John. I had three offers, very, you know, modest offers to direct and to write and direct a screenplay, a film of This Is Our Youth. And I went with John. I liked him a lot. And also he was the only one of the three who said that I would have final cut. I'd been making a living doing screenwriting. So I knew that if I didn't retain complete creative control, I would be very unhappy. I was really nervous about, I never thought about shots before. I never thought about like how I wrote the script and I had a couple of ideas for shots, but I never thought about how I wanted it to look. I interviewed some cinematographers and one of them said, you know, watch a lot of movies that you like and see what you want to rip off. Because he said it'll never look like that anyway, but it'll give you a starting place. I wanted to keep it simple. I ended up mostly looking at Coal Miner's Daughter, which many of you may have seen. I hope you have. It's one of the great movies. And that film is shot really naturalistically, but the shots are very selected and it's subtly but very carefully shot. And I looked at a film called The Best Years of Our Lives, which is one of my favorite movies. And that scene is all about, you know, these three soldiers who come back from World War II to their hometown. And my film has a lot of stuff about homecoming in it. So with that, it's not a great black and white epic, but there's some things about the way the scenes play out that was useful to me. I told everybody I met that I didn't know anything. And I said, and I'm not embarrassed to be ignorant. I really don't know what I'm doing. So I had a lot of help. And I asked for a lot of help. And I think people appreciated my not pretending to know stuff I didn't know. And it was a small enough movie that I could really concentrate on every element. And I found that I had lots of backup for what I had written in my head that I wasn't aware of.
I don't want to trade insults with you.
I don't want to be fired, Brian. I've been working here for 7 years.
Well,
you know, and if I were you, I'd be a little nervous about firing an employee I just had an affair with, okay?
What? Hey, don't threaten me, Sammy.
I'm not threatening you.
I'm not threatening you.
Well,
I think it's an area that we ought to explore.
You explore it. I'm going back to work.
You know, there's an emotional content to each scene, and there's a story content to each scene, and the way where you put the camera can really help reinforce that and reflect it and can tell you things that you can't be told any other way. So, for instance, this is really small example, but there's a scene where they're having dinner and they're all supposed to be getting along. And I said, this is just a really happy, cheerful scene. Everyone's getting along really well. And he said, well, then maybe we should start out with some energy. And he said, one way you can do that is you can have Laura come in and the camera can be going the opposite direction. That tends to create a little visual energy. And it's not like a big action shot or anything like that. All she's doing is walking in from the kitchen. The camera's going the other way, but it does create a certain cross movement. And then it swings around and follows them as they sit down at the table. And I didn't know anything like that. You just start talking about the specifics of what's happening in the story and you find yourself having visual ideas. And then later, as I got used to doing that, I'd have more and more.
You have these palpable emotional experiences that come out of your films with very specific scenes. And in film, that's a hard thing to do. You know, usually you're building it up over sort of linear scenes that lead you to an emotional place. Yours sometimes just come out of nowhere and they don't feel linear because you don't follow any of the rules of screenwriting books.
All those books are bad. Anyway, so I actually do feel like I'm following a line of an emotional line and a line of action, even though it may not seem very action-packed. But I'm really trying to think what's happening, what's the situation, where are the characters at, and what happens next. And when it's going well, you don't really have to think about those things. Everyone knows that nice feeling when it's flowing and you really feel like you're in the zone. And that's when I think you're unconscious, which is the most interesting part of you, is doing the real work. And then when you get stuck, I think I ask myself, I think the same questions everybody else does. What's happening? What's going to happen next? I wasn't just thinking about the whole thing unconsciously, but anything that feels right, I trust is right. And if it feels wrong, I trust that it probably is wrong.
It's a great example of how that rule is broken and it works extremely well, so well that it got you an Oscar. And it's that scene, and I believe I read something where Casey Affleck talked about that was one of the things on the page that really got him, and it's the part that breaks every rule. So you should find out about the tragedy based on screenwriting lore in the first act. And yet you've woven it somewhere into what would be page-wise your second act, you're almost 50 pages in before you find out what really happened.
Look, Lee, you made a horrible mistake, like a million other people did last night. I'm not gonna crucify you. It's not a crime to forget to put the screen on the fireplace.
So I can go?
Well, if something comes up we don't already know about, yeah.
You know, you have this utterly tragic moment that you experience and then extending it into this police station where he actually essentially confesses. I just want to hear about how you decided to do it there and why.
Principally, I was following my interest. I mean, I started out writing this story chronologically and it was boring. I didn't like it. It was kind of dull, and it also seemed like just this accumulation of misery that was just brutal and abusive. So I threw out everything I had, and I started again with him shoveling snow, which was the first scene that I actually liked. And that created a flashback structure that I felt right, and I wasn't sure why. It's a combination of weaving what feels right to you into the structure and then figuring out why it worked way later. So this is a combination of what I was doing at the time and what I found out later in the editing room, thanks to my editor. It's not actually arbitrary when that flashback comes. When he has to go home, naturally he starts thinking about why he doesn't want to be there. And the reason why he doesn't want to be there is that he can't bear the memories that he has of the place. And naturally, when he goes there, they come up much more strong. He spends his whole life trying to fend them off. He's very busy all day long. And as it happened, that idea, which was natural and truthful, I guess, automatically made me give him a job, which involves a lot of busy work and a lot of contact with people who he doesn't have an interaction with, but it's harder to keep your thoughts away from you when you have someone else in the room. And then the flashbacks start to accumulate when he starts to go home. And I had a whole lot of material that I'd written already for what had happened in the past. And I just started to layer them in. And I wondered whether they should be in smaller fragments and I kept thinking, well, that's not really how your memory works. You really think you have a flash of a moment and then you have another flash of a moment. But I kept writing scenes. So I ended up leaving it that way, and I figured whoever was going to direct it could chop him up if he wanted to or she wanted to. And then when he's in the lawyer's office and he's told he's got to stay there, then the main event comes up. And later on, I realized, oh, this is really structurally good because you have this sort of as a mild mystery, why is he like this? And you're slowly finding out more and more about his past. He's very different in the past. So I unintentionally created a slight problem to be solved narratively. And then when you find out what happened and why he can't stand to be there, you really can understand why. And at that moment, it's when he's stuck because he's been given charge of his nephew. And on top of all the antisocial behavior we've seen from him, you've also seen that he's very dutiful and he gets up there right away. He takes care of everything properly. He's not just duty bound to make the arrangements. He's duty bound to make sure that he's the one who tells his nephew that his brother is dead. And he makes sure he gives the kid the chance to go to the hospital and see the body if he wants. So he's trying to be, he's in this funny distance way, he's trying to do the right thing the whole time. So when he gets the guardianship of the kid, as it happens, it creates a big conflict. So you don't just have a revelation of what's wrong with him so that you're upset about it. It then propels the story into the next phase. That is purely accidental. I didn't let the story become diffused or stop dead. And when that happens, I have this sort of dead feeling inside and I know something's wrong and I try to fish around for what's going to make me feel alive again. And that's what I landed on. And then later on, my editor said this brilliant thing and she said, it's two stories. It's not flashbacks. He's got this in his mind so much that it's always in his head. And so we're just seeing the two sides. We're seeing what's happening to him outside and what's happening to him inside. And I thought that was really a really great way to put it.
This whole concept of tragedy in all your films, you know, even the first one, even You Can Count on Me, starts out with its parents dying. Can you talk about why is that a driving force in Manchester? It's huge, but in Margaret, it was huge too. So
I really don't know. I mean, that's a sort of a, I don't mean this is an invasive question, but it's a personal question because I don't know. You know, you do enough work over time, you see certain interests of your own emerging without necessarily knowing why. There's certain things that I just can't process. And I guess those are the things that you end up writing about, possibly. I don't know why some interests come out through your writing and others don't. I wish I did know. I wish I could write about everything that I'm interested in. I guess it seems dramatic to me. I'm compelled by it. I don't quite know what to do with human suffering. Nobody really seems to. And I think I don't have any philosophical system that helps me through all the terrible things that go on in the world and all the moderately terrible, you know, not all the unhappy things that everyone has, even if you have a comparatively good life. I lost two close friend and my mother-in-law in the last year. I don't know what to do about that. They're just gone. I'm not religious. I don't think I'm ever going to see them again, and I don't know what to make of it. So I guess it bothers me a lot, and it's really sad. I don't know where to put that. So maybe that's part of what feeds my work.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mites. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October.
PRI, Public Radio International.